The following recording was produced by Christ Redeemer Church of Hanover, New Hampshire. The speaker is Doug Cooper. You may find more information on the church and its various resources on the web at www.christredeemerchurch.org.
Passage is found on page 6 and Psalm 25. Show me your ways, Lord. Teach me your paths. Guide me in your truth and teach me, for you are God my Savior, and my hope is in you all day long. Remember, Lord, your great mercy and love, for they are from old. Do not remember the sins of my youth and my rebellious ways. According to your love, remember me, for you, Lord, are good. Good and upright is the Lord. Therefore, he instructs sinners in his ways. He guides the humble in what is right and teaches them his ways. All the ways of the Lord are loving and faithful toward those who keep the demands of his covenant. For the sake of your name, Lord, forgive my iniquity, though it is great. Who then are those who fear the Lord? He will instruct them in the ways they should choose. They will spend their days in prosperity, and their descendants will inherit the land. The Lord confides in those who fear him. He makes his covenant known to them. My eyes are ever on the Lord. For only he will release my feet from the snare. Turn to me and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted. Relieve the troubles of my heart and free me from my anguish. Look on my affliction and my distress and take away all my sins. This ends the reading of the Lord's Word.
All right. One of these times I'm going to get that right. You guys just wait. It's going to happen. So, in case you weren't here with us last week we were considering the weight of our words, and I got a lot of feedback about that message, which tells me that there was something there that was very relevant for us. And one of the passages that we referenced when we were looking at that is the bit that's included on your page there from Proverbs chapter 1, verses 8 and 9 there. So last week we looked at a psalm and some proverbs. This week we're doing the same thing. Now, as we considered the weight of our words together, one of the big ideas that came through was the fact that before we were ever speakers, before we were a bunch of chatterboxes like we all are, we were hearers. We listened first. Before we started linking words together, if you go back all the way back, before we started linking words together and forming sentences and ideas, we were all listening to, we were all taking in language. And ultimately, before we ever spoke, ultimately, God spoke. God spoke to us. He was the first one to utter words, and his words, they came with great significance and great power. He spoke the world into existence. And our words, because he has created us to be speakers, our words likewise hold significance and power as well. Life and death are in the power of the tongue, is what we were reading from Proverbs 18 last week. And so in order that our words might hold true significance and be life-giving, that they might impart love and life to others, I think that we need to come back around to this idea of what it really means for us to be hearers first and foremost. And David, who wrote Psalm 25, which you just heard read, he, or at least at this moment when he wrote Psalm 25, he really understood this idea of what it means to truly be a hearer. He had a solid grasp of it. And so Psalm 25 has us continuing to consider what it means for us to be hearers, to be listeners, to be learners, or to steal from our call to worship from Isaiah 55 that Reese led us through a moment ago, to consider what it might look like for us to really thirst and hunger for words from God, and to then hear God saying back to us, what is it that we recited? Listen. Listen to me. And eat what is good, and your soul will delight in the richest of fare. Give ear and come to me, God says to us. Give ear and come to me. Hear me, that your soul may live. And so the heart of Psalm 25 that we've got here is David's desire to do that. David's desire to hear from God, to learn from God, to know his voice, to know his ways. That's the heart of Psalm 25. And then what David demonstrates for us in the midst of this request that he's extending to God, what he demonstrates for us is the actual heart and disposition of one who is in fact teachable. We can learn from him here. To put it another way, he demonstrates what it is to be one who is well positioned to hear from and to learn from God. So we can learn a lot here from David about what it means to be a learner. And David understood three things that left him longing to be a listener and a learner. That was alliteration, by the way. Did you catch that? You guys know what alliteration is? Same first letter of the word. It left him longing to be a listener and a learner. And I hope you guys like alliteration, because I've got more of it as soon as we get around to some of these points that we're going to be walking through together. So let me state them now. So three things that David can teach us. First off, we will see that David had a clear conception of the situation that he was in. He had a clear conception of the situation. In other words, he recognized his own need. He saw it clearly, and he recognized God's gracious disposition towards his need. He had a clear conception. Secondly, he shows a reasonable response to the situation. And we'll look at that. And then lastly, we see that David has a sure solution to the situation in his sights. In other words, he's got a long view. He has a long view of what's going on here. And this is the thing that truly drives him to be a listener and to be a learner. So again, David's got a clear conception, reasonable response, sure solution. So a clear conception of the situation, what is that all about? Well, if you comb through Psalm 25, what you're going to find there is three occasions in which David describes the kind of person that God gives instruction and guidance to. And I've already said this before, but I just want to keep kind of articulating this in different ways so that we understand. Another way of saying that is that David describes the disposition of the person, who's truly teachable, who's well-positioned to really hear and learn from God. He describes, another way of putting this is, he describes the posture of the pupil. There's more alliteration for you, okay? And the first time that this comes up is in verse 8. This is where the clear conception comes through. But to get the full picture of this, just look back with me at verse 6, and we'll go through 6 through 8 here. Remember, Lord, your great mercy and love, for they are from of old. Do not remember the sins of my youth and my rebellious ways. According to your love, remember me, for you, Lord, are good. And then here comes the first mention of God's instruction in verse 8. Good and upright is the Lord, therefore he instructs sinners in his way. So the first thing that we learn is that God instructs sinners, okay? So this is good, right? I think we all qualify for this. This is good news. We all qualify. And there's something else that is funny here, to me at least. I hope somebody will laugh with me on this. I know that, and by the way, I'll say, I know that David is not trying to be humorous here, but did you notice something curious in verses 6 and 7 there? Notice in verse 6 he says to God, remember this. And then in verse 7 he says, don't remember this. So this is actually pretty bold of him. He's essentially saying, God, when you look at me, God, please remember who you are, okay? Remember who you are. When you look at me and you see my sin and you remember all of my rebellious old ways, please don't lose track of who you are. Please don't lose track of your great mercy and your great eternal love. Don't lose track of that. But then he says something else. What's the other thing he says? Where is it? And also, when you look at me and you see all of my sin, you remember all my rebellious ways. The other thing is, would you just forget about me? Don't remember me, okay? Don't remember my sin. Forget all about this. Remember this part. Remember who you really are. But please, would you forget about who I really am? Is what he's saying here. So David, he understands our ultimate need. Now, jokes aside, the reason why David is praying in this way is because he understands. He understands his position before God. So this, I think it's right to say that this is an oddball sort of a thing that he's doing here, because he's essentially asking God to experience some kind of like divine amnesia somehow. Like, would you just forget somehow, God? But despite that, David knew that this was no laughing matter. My jokes aside, he wasn't laughing. He knew it was serious. He knew that in reality, his sin created a huge, ugly wedge that was between he and God. It created a huge rift. And so he was able to see that it stood in the way of him being able to really hear, to really take in, to hear the voice of God, and to be taught by God in the ways that he needed to, in the ways that he wanted to. And this is, here's the thing, he wanted to. Do you get that coming through? He really wanted to. Show me your ways, Lord. Teach me. Teach me your paths. Guide me in your truth and teach me. For you are God, my Savior, and my hope is in you all day long. He wanted to make that connection. Here's what he wanted to do. He wanted to go back to the garden. He wanted to hear God's voice without the static, no distortion. He wanted a pure frequency. He wanted to really hear from God. And an interesting thing to notice here, I think, is that David saw the need for sin to truly be dealt with in a thoroughgoing, ultimate kind of a way. Do you see that? In this remember, don't remember bit that he's got here, he's saying, is there a way to completely erase my sin from your memory? Like, is there a way to just wipe it out once and for all for good? And so David is seeing clearly here. He understands his position before God, and we see it in his disposition before God. Do you see that? He's engaging the situation with clarity and with honesty. He's being bold. I said that a minute ago. But what's he doing? He's being bold in all the right kinds of ways. In all the right kinds of ways. In other words, he realizes he's got no leverage. He has no bargaining chips to bring to the table. And so his full appeal, 100%, is on the goodness of God. According to your love. He's not saying, according to, you know, I've been doing this and, you know, remember that. No, he's just like, according to your love, God. Remember me, for you, Lord, are good. He's banking on the goodness of God. And here, he is connecting with God's disposition. Okay, we talked about his disposition, now we're talking about God's disposition. So not only does he have a clear conception of the situation as it relates to himself, he has a clear conception as it relates to God. And so in verse 8, he confidently says this, good and upright is the Lord, therefore he instructs sinners in his ways. He had confidence in God's posture and disposition towards broken people. Towards broken people. This might remind you of something else that David says in another psalm. If you guys are familiar with Psalm 51, this comes through really clear, the same dynamic. At the close of Psalm 51, he describes the teachable disposition of the broken sinner intersecting with the gracious disposition of a merciful God. He says, this is in verse 16 of Psalm 51, in case anybody wanted to write that down. You do not delight in sacrifice, or I would bring it. You do not take pleasure in burnt offerings. So in other words, he's just like, I've got nothing. I've got nothing to bring to the table here. And then in verse 17, he says, my sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit. A broken and a contrite heart, you, God, will not despise. So what's he talking about here? He's talking about a perception of the mind, but he's also talking about a disposition of the heart. One that God can and will instruct, because a broken and a contrite heart is a teachable heart. That's what we learn from David. And God's gracious disposition is to instruct sinners in his ways. He's up for that. That's good news. And so here's the big question that we need to keep asking as we move along through this passage together. Am I teachable? Are you teachable? Is this the perception of your mind? Is this the disposition of your heart? Show me, teach me, guide me. Please, don't deal with me according to who I really am. God, deal with me according to who you really are. meet me with your grace and your love. So are you teachable? Are you teachable? So we've seen what a clear conception of the situation looks like. But what about a reasonable response? And so where do we see, I mentioned that there's three times where this instruction comes up. Where do we see the second one coming up? And it comes up right away. It comes up in verse 9 there. David tells us that God guides the humble in what is right and teaches them his way. And so God instructs sinners in his ways, and now we're reading that he guides and teaches the humble as well. So what's this all about? What does this mean? Because this can be actually a very confusing word. I'm always having interesting conversations about humility. And the thing is David doesn't actually tell us a whole lot about humility. He doesn't go into detail. He doesn't really describe it for us. What he does do, however, is he demonstrates it for us. He shows us what it looks like. He shows us what it sounds like. For instance, contrary to what many people often think about humility, it isn't about something that we're not. It isn't about something that we're attaining to. It isn't about attaining something new. Rather than that, humility has something to do with seeing. It has something to do with perception. To put it in the words of Charles Spurgeon, the old English preacher, he said, humility is to make a right estimate of oneself. And so it's not about becoming something new, per se. It has more to do with recognizing who you really are. Sound familiar? I love the way that author Hannah Anderson put this in her book, Humble Roots. She points out that our English word for humility finds its root in the Latin word humus, which means dirt or means earth. So it's not just about bean dip, okay? It means earth or dirt in the Latin. And I love the way that she brings this idea across. She says, linguistically at least, there is an intrinsic connection between the ground, our humanity, and humility. In other words, humility begins by remembering where we come from. Humility begins by remembering that to be human is to be dirt. Sounds insulting, but it's true. Humility begins by remembering that we are dust, and to dust we shall return. And so to be humble is to get our heads around who it is that we really are. And so this is probably sounding pretty familiar, like I said. A clear conception of who we really are. This is what we see in David here. He's got a clear conception of who he really is before God, and what does it do? What does that clear conception do for him? It leads him into this sweet, tender state of dependence. Show me. Guide me. Teach me, God. My hope is in you all day long. And this is a big part of humility. But there's another part of humility that David demonstrates for us. One scholar that I came across pointed out that implied in this word humble that's being used in verse 9 here is the idea of obedience, which may sound kind of odd at first until you stop to think about it a little bit. Because what does obedience even mean? What does it mean? Obedience means to listen, right? To listen and then to act on what you've heard. It means to be taught and to then walk in the way, right? This is like stealing language from David here, to then walk in the way of that teaching. And then to say, hey, show me your ways, Lord, teach me, guide me. Why would you say that? Why is David saying, show me, teach me? So that he can do it. So that he can walk in that way. He guides the humble in what is right and teaches them his way. And so humility isn't just something that you have, it's also something that you do. It isn't just an attitude, it's also an action. It's got feet. It walks. And coming back to what I was saying just a minute ago, oftentimes humility has nothing to do with the way that we're feeling. And David's a perfect example of this. This is one of the things that I find most interesting about this psalm. You read all that he has said here, and he sounds like, until you get further along, he sounds like an all-star, okay? He sounds like he's got all of his boxes checked off. He's got this thing completely figured out. He's like the poster child of what it means to be teachable, right? What has he got? He's got a clear conception of who he really is. He's got a clear conception of who God really is. Check. check. He's got his theology right. He's radically confessional, check. He's got that going for him. He's dependent. He's crying out for guidance. He's got awe and wonder for God, check, check. Yeah, he's got insights on the type of person that God instructs and guides, check. And then you get to verse 16. And look at what he says there. This is really interesting. He says, turn to me and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted. Relieve the troubles of my heart and free me from my anguish. Look on my affliction and my distress and take away all my sins. Does this sound like a guy who's walking on like cloud nine with God? You know, just hanging ten with Jesus? No, it doesn't. He says, turn to me. Which implies what? Where are you? Be gracious to me. I'm lonely. So what's going on here? Maybe he's not teachable after all. Maybe he's not humble after all. And that's not it. Quite the opposite, actually. This is David walking in humility. He's following along obediently. He's following along, even though the way seems lonely and uncertain to him at this particular moment, because humility isn't just about something that we have. It's about something that you do. It isn't merely an attitude. It's also an action. Humility means that we continue to follow and to trust our good teacher even when life throws us really hard lessons. Because why? Because he's good. This is what David says. Because he's good, and I hope in you all the day long. In a perfect example of this, by the way, and I would say it's more than a perfect example. It's the primary example. It's the most essential example of this thing. It's something that we're going to be confessing together later on. Later on in our service, we have a time of shared confession. Like we had our call to worship, we have a confession of faith, and it'll come from Philippians chapter 2. And one of the things that we'll recite is verse 8 from chapter 2 of Philippians, which says, being found in human form, talking about Jesus right now, being found in human form, he humbled himself. How? It says, by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So, question, do you have an honest view of yourself? First and foremost, are you primarily a learner? Not someone who is identified primarily as somebody who is the learned, but someone who's a learner. Are you primarily independent or are you primarily interdependent? I mean, it's really good to think about life together when we talk about these things, because one of the ways that we really work out this vertical stuff of us and God is by sorting it out horizontally with one another. So what does that look like in your relationships with one another? Are you really a learner? Are you just a teacher? It's good to be a teacher. Are you just a teacher? Are you teachable? So, he instructs sinners in his ways. He guides the humble in what is right and teaches them his way. So what's the third one? And you see it in verse 12. It says, who then are those who fear the Lord? He will instruct them in the ways they should choose. So who is it that he's instructing? It's kind of a backward sentence. He's instructing those who fear the Lord. Okay? So the last descriptor that we get here of the one who is truly teachable, who's well-positioned to hear from and learn from God, is someone who fears the Lord. And so again, what does that mean? This is another one of those sort of confusing things that people talk about. And so let me do this. I find this very helpful as I try to wrestle with this idea of what does it mean to fear the Lord. I'm going to point us to a passage that in a way is a commentary. It really helps us to understand what it means or what it might mean for us to fear the Lord. And it comes from Psalm 147. And I'm going to read verses 7 through 11 to you. It says this, sing to the Lord with thanksgiving. Make melody to our God on the lyre. He covers the heavens with clouds. So what's being described to us is like the majesty and the wonder of who God is here, okay? He covers the heavens with clouds. He prepares rain for the earth. He makes grass grow on the hills. He gives to the beasts their food and to the young ravens that cry. And then verses 10 and 11. His delight, God's delight, is not in the strength of horses, nor his pleasure in the legs of man, in the pleasure of the warrior. And then get this next part. Listen to this. But the Lord takes pleasure in those who fear him, in those who hope in his steadfast love, in his unfailing love. And those things are paired together. He delights in those who fear him and those who hope in his steadfast love. Now that might even sound more confusing, actually, right? Because those two words typically are not used as synonyms. Fear and hope usually don't get paired together, but here they do. So what is this all about? And something that I have found to be really helpful is a description that I came across from pastor and author John Piper. He says this: suppose you were exploring an unknown glacier in the north of Greenland in the dead of winter. And I realize you guys probably don't want to use your imaginations in this way, okay, to think about the winter, but we're going to do it, okay? We're all in this together. It's a little warm in here. Suppose you were exploring an unknown glacier in the north of Greenland in the dead of winter. Just as you reach a sheer cliff with a spectacular view of miles and miles of jagged ice and mountains of snow, a terrible storm breaks in. The wind is so strong that the fear rises in your heart that it might blow you over the cliff. But in the midst of the storm, you discover a cleft in the ice where you can hide. Here you feel secure. But even though secure, the awesome might of the storm rages on, and you watch it with a kind of trembling pleasure as it surges out across the distant glaciers. At first, there was the fear that this terrible storm and awesome terrain might claim your life, but then you found a refuge and gained the hope that you would be safe. But not everything in the feeling called fear vanished from your heart, only the life-threatening part. There remained the trembling, the awe, the wonder, the feeling that you would never want to tangle with such a storm or be the adversary of such a power. The Lord takes pleasure in those who fear him, in those who hope in a steadfast love. So one way to describe the kind of teachable person that David is outlining for us here is to say that they have, this is going to sound familiar, that they have a clear conception of who God really is. You're noticing some themes that keep coming back around. That he's as fierce as a storm. He's as fierce as a storm, and yet he's got this ferocious, ferocious mercy and love that can keep us, that can protect us. And it can leave us with this kind of trembling pleasure. In other words, they hope in his steadfast love. Verse 11. They hope in his steadfast love. And here's the thing. This sounds great, doesn't it? Like all that I've been describing in the story that I just read. It sounds great, but how do we objectively experience it? How do we objectively experience this? Because the truth is, I don't know if you would agree with me on this or not, but I think that the truth is that none of us really, truly see ourselves as we really are. And that none of us truly see God as he really is. That we've got blind spots on both ends of that. That we're the ones with amnesia, okay? We're the ones that don't see clearly. And so how can we ever hope to experience the kind of clear-eyed humility that David's describing here? This kind of life-changing humility. Or to ask David's question, coming back around to this, to ask David's question, how is it that we can ever get out from underneath this sin? How is it going to happen? How are we going to do it? And it's not going to happen through divine amnesia. Well, how is it going to happen? It's going to happen through divine humility. Through divine humility. The only thing that can truly humble you and me is to have a direct encounter with the humility of God. To really see it. To really clearly conceive of it. So how do we get out from under our sin? Where do we run to find shelter from the storm of God's judgment for our sin? We run to Christ. We run to Christ. He is that cleft in the ice. He is that hiding place. He is the strong wall that endured the gale of God's judgment so that we could rest securely with a kind of trembling pleasure. He humbled himself. He did. How? How did he do it? By becoming obedient to the point of death. We just read that. Even death on a cross. This is the clear conception that we need, and it's the sure solution that we need and that he's provided for us. So, in closing here, I'm just trying to think about like how you're here, how you might be hearing this. You know, maybe as we've just kind of journeyed through Psalm 25 together, maybe the only thing that really stood out to you, that you really connected with, was verses 16 through 18. You know? Maybe you identified with that. Turn to me and be gracious to me, for I'm lonely and afflicted. And what I would say is, if that's you, hear the words of Jesus saying, come. Come to me. Listen. Let my words be taught by me. Let my words come in. Come to me. Let my words be as like a garland of grace. This is back to Psalm or Proverbs 1, 8 through 9. I just love that. Let my words be like a garland of grace about your head and like an ornament about your neck. Come to me and find rest for your souls. So, in closing, are you teachable? Are you teachable? And here's what I would say. It doesn't matter how you might answer that question. The important thing is, we need to come to the teacher. That's where things change. Or he's referred to as the teacher, but to put it in the words of Peter, come to the shepherd and guardian of your soul. Be found by him. Father, thank you for this good word. And Lord, I confess to you my own wrestlings in these things. If you don't do a work in me, I can't see how I'll change. And I think the same is true for my friends. And so, God, would you avail yourself to us? We've got so many blind spots. We don't see ourselves clearly. We don't see you clearly. So would you give us sight? Would you take some muck and smear it into our eyes and cure us of our blindness, so that we can see you and ourselves as we ought to? Would you humble us with this great mercy and love of yours, that we might really sit at your feet and be taught in the ways that our souls so need? We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.